Hello, everyone. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, depending on where you might be on planet Earth. Welcome to this event sponsored by the School of Public Policy at the LSE. When COVID hit a couple of years ago, it was pretty clear that the world financial community had to do more, especially to come and help developing and middle-income countries. And of course, in the first line of defense against a shock like COVID, are the multilateral development banks. And a big question hanging in the air, of course for a long time, but especially over the last couple of years, it what it is that we can do through policy design, through financial engineering, to allow multilateral development banks to lend more, to use their balance sheets more effectively so as to boost their lending power, transfer more resources to countries that need those resources, and as a result, help with economics, public health, and general human welfare. I'm very, very happy today to be chairing this event jointly hosted by the African Development Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, and the LSE School of Public Policy. The topic could not be more important, and as you will see, and I will introduce them in a few minutes, the roster of speakers and participants and discussants and commentators is absolutely spectacular. So thank you very much, everyone. This is how we're going to get started. We're going to begin with a few remarks from my friend and colleague, Eric Parrado, who's the chief economist and the general manager of research at the IDB. The IDB, through Eric and through my friend, Andy Powell, I've been very active in putting together and sort of helping design conceptually this event, so I'm thankful to both of them. Then we're going to have the presentation of a policy paper, which will sort of set the stage for what it is that we need to discuss, and also we'll present a few ideas on how it is that we can in fact boost the lending power of multilateral lending institutions. And then we will have some really distinguished comments from really distinguished commentators, including people from the development banks themselves and also from the private sector. We want to do academic analysis, but we also want to make sure that things happen, and therefore market participants are absolutely key in this kind of debate. And toward the end, in the last half hour, we are going to make sure that we have enough time to take questions from the audience. So if you are listening in, please don't be shy about typing in your questions in the chat or in the Q&A function, and I will try to cover as many of those questions as possible. All right, enough from me. Without further ado, let me hand it over to Eric Parrado to introduce today's seminar. Eric, thanks for being here. Floor is yours.
Many thanks, Andres. And on behalf of the Inter-American Development Bank, I would like to thank you, Andres, and your team at the School Public Policy at LSE for organizing and hosting this very interesting and innovative event. We have had an excellent partnership with LSE over the years, and I hope to see that continue with many more events such as this one, combining the knowledge and convening power of our two institutions is a win-win, and it's a great pleasure to be collaborating with LSE once again. And let me say a couple of words about the role of the multilateral development banks and the IDB in particular. NDBs play an important role in the international financial architecture as the leading providers of long-term development finance at highly competitive interest rates, but at the same time, NDBs provide technical assistance and knowledge. NDBs lend in virtually every sector and are involved in policy discussions with governments over most important development policy decisions. At the IDB, we have a vision which guides our priorities for lending. It is known as Vision 2025. Our aim is to restore Latin America and the Caribbean development path through a renewed focus on five critical areas. First of all, regional integration, by supporting the reconfiguration of global value chains and integration initiatives. Second, the digital economy, by facilitating access and creating the capacity to embrace digital technologies and foster innovation. Third, support for small and medium-sized enterprises by generating the conditions to maximize the private sector's contribution to the recovery. Fourth, climate change, of course, by helping countries foster resilience, mitigation, and adaptations, and finally, but not less important, gender equality and diversity by empowering women and vulnerable populations who have been bearing most of the burden of the health and economic crisis. By focusing on these areas in terms of financing and providing knowledge, we hope to make a real difference in the LAC region as countries recover from the COVID-19 crisis and as they now adapt to the new global economy, given the Russia-Ukraine conflict and the challenges, of course, of fiscal and monetary policy normalization in advanced economies. To provide financing, MDBs issue bonds on international markets and lend the money raised to countries. But MDBs are constrained in the amount of debt they can issue by the capital that they have. That capital is provided by the shareholders. In the case of the ADB, the shareholders are 26 borrowing members, countries, and 22 non-borrowing members, including the UK. But within these constraints, MDBs are continually trying to find ways to lend more with the capital that they have been given. The recent new SDR allocation may provide additional resources for development finance. Paradoxically, however, richer economies that do not really require access to these resources have received over 50% of that amount. In contrast, Africa and Latin America and the Caribbean, whose needs are far greater, have received about 5% and 8% respectively. So that has sparked an interesting debate about how to best recycle SDRs from richer to poorer countries. The IMF already does some recycling through something called the Poverty Reduction and Growth Trust, which has been largely focused on low-income countries, and the IMF is now working on a new vehicle named the Resilience and Sustainability Trust. MDBs, as the traditional suppliers of long-term development finance, can also play a role in SDR recycling. There are several ideas on the table for how MDBs can get involved. That attempt to harness the knowledge built by MDBs, especially now on the topic of the climate transition and the potential financial firepower that stems from the SDR allocation. But today's event is focusing on other techniques and specifically on the potential and the obstacles for risk transfer to play a greater role. Risk transfer here means how MDBs can remove risks from their balance sheets to create space to then be able to originate and lend more to borrowing member countries. This is also distinct from mobilization, which refers how to MDB can co-lend or through other techniques, crowd in additional lending from other lenders, including the private sector. I'm particularly pleased that today's discussion on risk transfer will be motivated by the presentation of an ADB working paper written by two authors from the ADB, my friends Federico Galicia and Andy Powell, and two external authors, William Perrodin and Tim Turner. The paper was very well timed as while there have been other publications in the area. No paper has put together the complete treatment of the topic as we will hear from the authors today. It is also well timed as the G20 has made the discussion of the optimization of MDB balance sheets a focus of discussion and have formed a working group to analyze MDB capital levels. And I understand the paper was recently presented to members of that working group. In addition, as you said in your introduction, we also have four fantastic and knowledge discussants that I understand Andres will introduce now. So I just want to extend a very sincere thank you to each of them for being here with us today. It's a very full agenda, so I don't want to take more time on this, but let me thank everyone once again for being here today, and I look forward very much to the discussion. I will pass the microphone back to you, Andres. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Eric. Thank you for that, especially for reminding us how large the gap has been in spending power in response to the pandemic. I think everybody on this call knows the numbers, but rich countries were able to spend twice as much as emerging nations, and emerging nations were able to spend twice as much as low-income nations, as a share of GDP, of course, which simply underscores the urgency of the issues that we're talking about today. Let me now move to the paper, the main presentation that will then provide food for thought for the discussion. As Eric said, this is a paper put together at the IDB, but not exclusively by IDB staff members. The official formal title is Risk Transfer for MDBs, Obstacles and Opportunities. The authors are Federico Galicia, William Perodin, Andy Powell, and Tim Turner. I am going to hand it over to them for about 20 minutes so that we can hear from them about the main points of the paper, and then we will move over to comments. Over to you guys, thanks very much.
Thank you, Andres. This is Tim, and I'm gonna kick things off by giving a little background on the motivation for this paper. As you indicated, all of the authors have been involved in risk transfer and what is now known as balance sheet optimization for development banks in some form or other for a long period of time. And collectively, we were wondering why risk transfer has not grown at the pace that we would have expected, given what we think is the potential benefits of risk transfer. Despite the fact that there's been a number of very successful risk transfer structures used by development institutions, and despite the fact there's been a call to scale development finance, as the term has been coined, billions to trillions, by catalyzing private investment. As we got into this subject, we also were trying to understand what were some of the obstacles that were preventing risk transfer from being used more frequently, and in fact, what can be done about them. And then finally, we were interested in trying to quantify a little bit more about risk transfer. Many people were looking at risk transfer as sort of the silver bullet, so to speak, to enable multilateral institutions to scale. And we really wanted to put some numbers behind that and create some quantification of the realistic expectations. So today's presentation is going to be organized in three parts. Federico Galicia, the CRO at the Inter-American Development Bank, will outline a few examples of successful risk transfer transactions that have been done by other MDBs. Andy Powell, the Deputy Chief Economist at the Inter-American Development Bank, will talk about some of the obstacles that we identified for scaling risk transfer and perhaps some of the ways that we might address this. And then finally, William Perodin, the CEO of Risk Control, a risk management consultancy based in London, will then analyze the potential for risk transfer to be scaled and to support additional development finance. So with that, let me now hand it over to Federico to introduce and talk a little bit about some of the other successful risk transfer instruments that have been used by multilateral institutions. Thank you. Hey, you have to unmute, Federico.
And now that you can hear me, let's move to the Juncker plan, which is the largest scale risk transfer in being, where we have actually dozens of billions multiplied into hundreds of billions of mobilization. And the core aspect of risk transfer you see on the bottom of the chart, which are both the top and the bottom, but the EU guarantee and the European Investment Bank taking first losses. A first loss over a portfolio is a very powerful multiplier effect. It's akin to what equity does for a corporate. And by transferring the risk on its loan portfolio under the Juncker plan to the European Commission, the EIB has been able to achieve a multiplier of 10, 15 times. So a total of initially 20 billion got multiplied to 300 billion of mobilization. And the scheme has since been enlarged to a total of 500 billion. What I want to leave you with in respect to this example is the power of multiplication that you get when a multilateral development bank receives a guarantee. And this is particularly important because a number of asset managers are asking policymakers to do the opposite. They're asking policy funds to guarantee asset managers. That's useful, but less efficient than vice versa, guaranteeing a multilateral development banks. And I'm going to explain why this is so efficient with the next two examples. So if you go to the guarantee structure that the Inter-American Development Bank set out with the Swedish International Development and Cooperation Agency, we take advantage of a special status of a multilateral development bank, which is called preferred creditor treatment. This means that as long as a sovereign country has reserves, they try to privilege payments into the debt service they have with a multilateral. This also means that if there were to be a crisis and if a country were to run out of reserves, once balance is restored, the multilateral is the first in line for the arrears to be resolved. We took advantage of these characteristics to structure a very efficient guarantee from Sweden. Sweden has a rating of AAA, and they guarantee a sovereign exposure of 100 million on a country where, which is a large country in the region, where we have a large exposure. The terms of the guarantees are super simple. As long as the IDB payments are on time, the guarantee is not triggered. If there is a delay of more than 180 days on payments to IDB from the country, the guarantee is triggered. All principal is paid in until the time as the situation is resolved, and the IDB will return all principal payments to the guarantor. This is a super efficient mechanism that allows for a very low pricing of a guarantee, also on the basis of our preferred creditor treatment. Over 70 episodes of defaults in Latin America over the past 60 years, only 10 times countries were late with the IDB. And leveraging this through risk transfer leads to a very significant multiplication of those 100 million of guarantees, resulting to 300 million of additional lending. It's a pilot scheme, but it can be stepped up. Let me close with a third example where some of the colleagues and discussants worked, and I'm gonna leave them to them during the discussion to explain. This is a portfolio guarantee on a set of loans that are to the private sector. This is a case where there's no sovereign guarantee. So the preferred creditor treatment is restricted to currency convertibility, but still we were able to document a very strong credit performance of multilateral development banks, and we were able to tranche the structure of liabilities with a first loss, a mezzanine, and a senior tranche, where the mezzanine was placed A, with market investors, and again, the European Commission, which helped closing the gap. Again, the multiplier effect and the savings of capital is very significant. And William, in the third section of the paper, will tell you a bit more about it. So again, three examples that show you really the power of risk transfer when it is done through and with the help of multilateral development banks. Over to Andy to tell you about the reason why this has not been scaled up to date.
Thank you, Federico, and thanks to Andres and again and his team for hosting this event. Yeah, so my job here is to talk about the obstacles and also how we might be able to surpass some of these obstacles. So Federico already mentioned preferred creditor treatment, and one of the concerns with risk transfer has been regarding preferred creditor treatment in the sense that there's been some concern that if MDBs transfer some of the risk off their balance sheet and give that risk to others, Federico just described a couple of transactions, then maybe in for some reason those loans, the borrowers will somehow change their behavior and suddenly treat these loans as somehow not preferred. And so they will not enjoy the same kind of repayment history that we've seen when loans have been maintained on MDB balance sheets. So that has been a concern that has been raised. Now, we think this concern is overblown. It's overblown for a number of reasons. First of all, through these risk transfer transactions, the MDBs actually remain what's called the lender of record. So the MDB still remains as the originator and the lender of record to the borrower. and has the and continues to have the relationship with the borrower, the risk transfer does not change that. In fact, in some of these transactions, the borrower may not even know that some of part of their claims have been transferred. So if they don't know that the claims have been transferred, then it's hard to argue that their behavior is going to change. And we also have to bear in mind that in most cases, these transfers are synthetic. It's not like, you know, there's a specific loan that built a particular factory or that was given to a government for a particular reason, that loan with a name has now gone from the balance sheet of the MDB and is sitting on somebody else's balance sheet. No, these are more like synthetic transactions which transfer risk, but don't actually transfer a specific loan. But still, you know, there still seems to be this concern out there, and perhaps there's some confusion. And I think part of the issue that the confusion may arise is that preferred creditors treatment itself is not normally written into the contracts that MDBs use. It's what's known as a market practice. So it's the behavior of the borrowers, but it's not actually written into the legal contracts, generally speaking. But it is mentioned in a number of places that MDBs should be treated as preferred. Where is it mentioned perhaps most prominently? In what's called the Paris Club. So the Paris Club is the club of bilateral lenders who lend to developing countries in general. And you know, in the context of a debt restructuring, there's not only debt restructuring of private debt that most people I'm sure have been aware of, but there's also restructuring of official debt, which through the Paris Club. So the Paris Club has what is called an equal treatment clause that says that creditors in the context of a restructuring should be treated in some sense equally. So in other words, if the official sector gives a country a haircut, in other words, reduces the debt burden on a particular country, then it would expect the private sector to also give some relief or restructure the debts in some way. But that equal treatment clause has an exclusion, a specific exclusion for MDBs and also for the IMF, which is also considered as a preferred creditor. So the Paris Club does mention quite prominently that there is an exception to this equal treatment clause. So perhaps one way of resolving this confusion and providing greater clarity would be the Paris Club should make a generic statement that this exception to the equal treatment clause applies not just to loans which are maintained on MDB balance sheets, but it applies to all loans originated by MDBs, where the MDBs remain the lender of record, whether they remain on the balance sheet of the MDB or whether some of that risk is transferred through one of these operations. So that is our first obstacle and a first potential solution. Now, there is a more general concern about preferred creditor status preferred creditor treatment that let me mention very briefly, which is, you know, if preferred lenders sort of lend too much, then maybe at some point, then they may be less preferred, because it's a bit the same as, you know, if a corporation has all debt, then actually this debt becomes kind of more like equity. That's a joke in corporate finance. But we think we're quite far a long way from that point for most countries that at least at the IDB and I presume other MDBs lend to. So, and in fact, Federico and some of his colleagues in the risk area at the IDB have done some empirical work that shows very little relation between the amount of preferred lending and the quality of the repayment history of those loans. And actually that work was instrumental in changing some of the rating agencies' policies in that regard. So we think we're quite far away from that. From that boundary. Now I mentioned the rating agencies. That is our second point. It may sound a little harsh, but the rating agencies may be an obstacle to greater risk transfer in the following sense. That, you know, it's critical the ratings that these transactions obtain And I'm sure we'll hear this from the private sector participants in the panel. It's critical what ratings they attain to that for the transaction to be successful and for the MDB to be able to offload the risk in an economic way and in a way that makes sense economically. Now, what rating agencies are, of course, are a business, and they have a set of tools that they've developed over time. In fact, they've developed these tools in general to look at securitization type transactions that are very common in the private sector. So the tools that they use are similar to the tools that they've developed for commercial lenders. And they may not be 100% appropriate in terms of their overall design, all the parameters that are used when it comes to analyzing an MDB risk transfer transaction. Now, this may be something of a kind of chicken and egg problem in the sense that because there have been so few transactions, perhaps it hasn't paid as yet for rating agencies to invest that much in attempting to revise these methodologies. Or you could also argue that there isn't that much history, so it's difficult for them to do so. But we do think that they have not taken into account the very high quality of the credit history that MDBs have. And so we think that that's an issue which should be looked at. Hopefully it will, as risk transfer operations become more common, rating agencies will give a more realistic, we would argue more realistic view as to what the parameters and the design in the tools that they use. And I think William may mention this a bit further in his intervention. And the third point is somewhat related, which is to do with information and transparency. Because there isn't really a fully developed database of MDB loans that captures the very low credit risk that MDBs have enjoyed, both in terms of their lending to sovereigns and also in terms of their lending to the private sector, which most MDBs also is also an important activity for many MDBs. So having a more detailed database available that covers the credit events that have happened, the few credit events that have happened, their timing and any losses incurred and how those events were resolved would surely help investors and the rating agencies understand this risk better. So we do think there's more work to be done by MDBs in this case to be more transparent and provide more data to the market, to investors, and to the rating agencies. There are some ongoing projects in this area. There's one in particular that's known as GEMS. Its name is a bit of a mouthful, the Global Emerging Markets Risk Database Consortium. And that's certainly one important project that could go deeper and allow for greater transparency. So that's our third obstacle and potential resolution technique. So with that, let me pass the microphone to William. William.
I guess I'm the tame financial engineer in our little team. So I'm going to show you some numbers, and I'm going to focus just on this one table. So what is this table? Well, it's a set of calculations aimed at showing you how risk transfers can help MDBs economize on their capital. So these calculations are done for a bank, and then a multilateral development bank, not a real one, because not quite in a position to use a particular bank's data for this exercise. My colleagues and I have looked at the detailed portfolio data of a whole bunch of MDBs. So for this purpose, we've constructed a notional MDB balance sheet. It's a granular level, so all the different individual loans. And we've done this using data, public data from the World Bank and the IDA, and then public data also from EBRD. So we've located this development bank in Asia, hoping not to offend any Asian MDBs, but we've constructed this MDB and located it in Asia. And then what we've done is we've considered some transactions. So here, what we're looking at, if you look at the upper panel particularly, which I'll focus on, we're looking at the effects of either $1 billion of additional lending by this MDB. So that's the second row where it says direct lending to corporates. So the base case is like where you start before you do this additional lending. So when they do the additional lending, their risk-weighted assets go up from 67 billion to 69 billion. And what else happens? Well, these calculations are done using a Standard & Poor's set of conventions. Standard & Poor's calculate a RAC ratio, so risk-adjusted capital ratio. And so this ratio is a key input to the Standard & Poor's rating of MDBs. So here you can see in the base case, this ratio is 32.8. Now this ratio is somewhat comparable to Basel. So Basel ratios, capital ratios revolve around 10%. Here, MDBs are AAA rated entities, mostly. So here there is a substantially higher RAC ratio of 32.8%. When the MDB does additional lending, its RAC ratio will fall. So here you can see that from that additional lending, its RAC ratio goes down to 0.86. There's a key trigger for MDBs, which is a 23% RAC ratio. So above 23%, you're rated in the highest category for capital adequacy, and that helps to sustain your rating. So all MDBs are, or most MDBs are a bit obsessed with their RAC ratio and adjust their lending and balance sheet management processes around keeping their RAC ratio above a trigger level. So if you say do an extra billion, your RAC ratio will fall by 0.86. That would raise the attention. It would get the attention of senior MDB managers, particularly somebody like Federico, who's the chief risk officer, but actually all senior management in MDBs are a bit obsessed with these things. So what happens if instead of direct lending of $1 billion, one did direct lending of $1 billion, but simultaneously did a securitization? And that's what the other rows are all about. So the other rows show that instead of your RAC ratio dropping 0.86, you can drop by 0.50, or depends upon the assets that you're securitizing. So you might say, well, 0.86 to 0.50, is that a big gain? I mean, it's not a massive gain, but it does mean that if you work out how much lending could I do when it's securitized, instead of $1 billion, for the same RAC ratio impact, you could do 1.7 billion, which is 0.86 divided by 0.5. So 1.7 billion sounds like a gain. This is all done with the existing rules of rating agencies. A key aspect of rating agency rules is that when they rate MDBs, they take account of preferred creditor treatment. They obviously have observed that MDBs' loans perform very well. So an MDB gets much better credit performance on, particularly on a sovereign loan, than say Citi or Morgan Stanley or some other big bank would get because of preferred creditor treatment. That is explicitly allowed for in the rules for rating MDBs, but it is not allowed for in the rules that rating agencies use for evaluating securitizations of MDB loans. Why is that important? It's important because when you do a securitization like this, you retain some tranches of risk. Those tranches of risk are then rated by the rating agency, and the results of that have to be accommodated in the rating that the rating agency gives to the bank. Since the rating agencies make no allowance for PCT in the ratings of the securitizations, that makes these risk transfers much less efficient. So I haven't done calculations here, but I would speculate that if you really worked out the, if you really rated the securitization retained tranches in a proper best guess way, then you would more than double. You know, so instead of 1.7, you'd be looking at 3 or 4. You'd really make a big impact on capital efficiency. So this is one of the 3 points that Andy was pointing out. And it shouldn't be a big argument with a rating agency to say, well, you've acknowledged PCT in the rating of the bank. Why do you not properly acknowledge it in the rating of securitizations? Okay, I'll hand over to Tim to conclude.
Okay, thank you, William. So just let me just summarize a couple of key conclusions. First of all, we have seen a number of successful risk transfer transactions that have been done by multilateral development banks, and Federico has kind of walked you through some of those, the major ones there. William has concluded that, you know, risk transfer in terms of scale can be material, but it's not a silver bullet, and it's not going to cause multilaterals to have many, many multiples in terms of their lending capacity. And that risk transfer will be a complementary way for multilaterals to scale, but they will continue to need recapitalization from their shareholders. So it's not a substitute, but a complement to that. Andy's identified a number of obstacles and proposed some solutions, those around preferred creditor treatment, around the rating agency methodologies, and also around the information asymmetries that exist today and how they can be resolved. And then finally, I think the major conclusion is that there are some obstacles that will, you know, can be resolved, but they should be then prioritized by the policy decision makers in order to address that and then allow multilaterals to reach this potential scale potential for risk transfer that is there. So that concludes our presentation. We look forward to questions and like to thank the many other participants that have helped supported preparation of this paper, including those discussants that will follow. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, everyone who presented the paper. I think this is a great and very useful contribution to the role that better financial design, financial engineering, if you want to call it that way, can help us use the balance sheet of multilateral lending institutions better so they can lend more and give countries that needed a bigger hand. But I am not the expert. We do have a bunch of very qualified experts, much more qualified than I, so I'm going to move over to them. We're going to begin with a view from the official world, from another important regional development bank, the African Development Bank, and we're very lucky to have Hassatou. Hassatou Diop-Nzele is the Chief Financial Officer of the African Development Bank, and we're going to hear first from her. So again, thank you very much for helping organize this, for co-sponsoring this, and thank you very much for joining us today with your comments.
Thank you very, very much, and hello to everybody. I'm the treasurer of the African Development Bank. I'm the acting vice president, finance and CFO. So it's a pleasure to be here and to have this discussion with you. Just a few words about the African Development Bank. We are the only AAA rated institution of the African continent. We are an MDB that is owned and controlled by all the 54 countries of Africa and 27 countries across Europe, North America, the Middle East, and Asia. And the US is the second largest shareholder of the African Development Bank. So the African Development Bank has a powerful mandate similar to that of the Inter-American Development Bank. It's about inclusive growth, and it's about bringing Africa or help Africa transition to green growth. So our mandate is powerful, social and economic, and our resources are limited. Our challenges are just formidable. And we operate in one of the most challenging areas of the world. And basically by nature, we just get penalized by rating agencies just because of our region of operations. So with an institution such as ours and the importance of that mandate, business as usual doesn't work. We have to operate differently in order to meet our mandate, and we have to be innovative. Eric Barrado alluded to SDRs, which is a formidable tool that was unleashed by the IMF. And yes, the MDB have to play a role that will magnify the impact of those SDRs. And as MDB, we can have a multiplier effect. $300 billion to MDB is $900 billion to $1.2 trillion to the productive economies, developing economies. So, but this is for another discussion. So we executed the MDB Exposure Exchange Agreement with the Inter-American Development Bank and the World Bank in 2015. And these transactions really allowed us to reduce our portfolio concentration and created about $10 billion of additional lending headroom with no compensation being due to the other MDBs. And it has paved the way for similar transactions in the market with other MDBs. We've also been using credit insurance to create more headroom. And for example, in 2019, we purchased the credit insurance on the partial credit guarantee we provided to the Republic of Senegal for a currency risk hedging transaction, which was carried out with the international and regional commercial banks. So at a time when there is a lot of concern about Africa, that sustainability, we believe that these type of transactions will allow the bank to increasingly assist countries to manage their debt profiles. That is very important. We became, and that was really a landmark transaction, we became the first MDB to execute a synthetic securitization of $1 billion on the private sector loan portfolio. And Tim Turner was working at the bank at the time as our chief risk officer, and he really spearheaded this transaction. The transaction involved Mariner and Africa 50 as private sector investors, and where the bank took a nominal first loss. So following the continued success of this type of transactions, we've designed BSO structures now, balance sheet optimization transactions, that support new transactions at the point of origination, providing from the onset an embedded capital consumption benefit. So, and as one of the bank, the MDBs that truly took to the G20 call to action on optimizing the balance sheet earlier on, we've encountered every single one of the three main points identified in the paper by the IADB. On the PCT, on the preferred creditor status, it has been a challenge when negotiating, for example, pricing. Many risk assessors, potential counterparties, are just not familiar with the impact that the PCS provides in terms of expected losses, time in arrears, and there is simply not enough data out there about MDB loan performance. So the conclusion that we all need to work together as a DFI community is to feed the GEMS that Andrew was talking about, or other relevant databases that is critical takeaway from the paper produced. So we also need a more independent advocacy around this forum, like this one, for example, to take on this topic. Even institutions of higher learning, like the LSEs, could look more into this as graduate research topics. So we've also identified a set of guiding principles that are designed to allow us to benefit from risk transfer, which we call internally balance sheet optimization transactions, on the public sector portfolios, on the sovereign portfolio, without compromising the preferred creditor status. So what we do, we have to remain the lender of record, implementing the projects, servicing the loans, and recovering any defaulted amount. So on our sovereign asset, we structure the credit protection, preferably on the sovereign portfolio exposure rather than on an individual sovereign loans. And we do not disclose the risk transfer counterparties to the borrowers, underlying obligors in general. So there should be no change in the bank's lending policies, and that is one of the principles as well that we have, including the application of sanctions upon any default during the risk transfer transactions. So with regards to the rating agencies, you know, we do believe similarly to themes evoked in the report that I'm not going to repeat, but there is really an opportunity for better appreciation of risk transfers as executed by multilateral development banks compared to commercial banks. And perhaps also more clarity required on this within the Basel framework. So with regards to, you know, it's like making decisions based on, you know, market practice can stifle innovation in how risk transfer arrangements evolve. So it's important to take into account the particularities and the specificities of MDBs. So rating agencies tend to be conservative, much more conservative when they are when there are alternatives, just as good approaches that could justify going another way. So on the issue of the Paris Club, I think that the conclusions of the paper are fair. Having a definitive global statement from Paris Club on the issue of whether they would continue to exclude MDBs loans from rescheduling, even if they are insured or otherwise credit enhanced, is a low-hanging fruit, particularly since what we're doing is a G20 initiative. So interestingly, we believe that there is an incentive for the Paris Club to support the MDB community on the BCT, and because it may be the only stakeholder in the market that accepts that rescheduling. So we need to try and make maybe this type of transaction more attractive to the Paris Club in order to sensitize them on their usefulness and also the you know, showcase the positive impact that they have on our operations. So going forward, we'll seek to further mainstream this into the recurring practices of the bank. Actually, it's actually the case. We have a framework that has been approved by the board of directors, and we're working on various transactions at different level. And despite the importance of risk transfer products, sometimes, and as shown by peer institutions, there remains, you know, occasional apprehensions about the loss in fee income. However, as long as the transaction complies with the internal metrics, which we don't really see that as an issue. So if all of these bottlenecks are quickly addressed, the potential for risk transfer as a tool for MDB is huge. The challenging overall market environment, the need to do more with less, the positive impact of balance sheet optimization transaction, which is generally recognized by rating agencies, the positive signal MDBs are giving to shareholders when trying to optimize their balance sheets are all reasons why I'm quite optimistic about the potential of this type of transactions going forward. So let me stop here.
Thanks very much for that careful analytic perspective and also a view from Africa. We're going to move on now to private sectors and I suppose academic or quasi-academic thoughts on the proposed plan and on the issue. We have three such comments. We're going to be hearing from Simon Besant, correct me if I'm getting it wrong, who's the board director and global head of insurance at the Texel Group. Then we will be hearing from Chris Canavan, who's a partner at Lionshead Global Partners, a financial advisory firm based in both New York and London. And we will be hearing from Nancy Lee, who's a senior policy fellow at the Center for Global Development in Washington, D.C. Simon, why don't we begin with you? And again, thanks very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Andreas. So 7 minutes, I'll try and cover the private insurance market and its applicability to balance sheet optimization and risk transfer for MDBs as quickly and succinctly as possible. Maybe as a brief starting point, I work for the Texel Group. We are a credit and a political risk insurance broker, specialist in this field. And we work with commercial, international, and development banks to try and help them utilize the insurance product to manage their balance sheet in an efficient way. When we're talking about the insurance product, we're talking about what is effectively treated by rating agencies and global regulators as a guarantee. So it's a credit substitution. The development banks or commercial lenders that utilize the product can substitute the rating of the borrower with the rating of the guarantor. And so in this case, what we're trying to achieve there is an efficiency for the buyer of the insurance, both on their credit limits that they're facing to their borrowers, to the countries, but also hopefully the balance sheet relief that they can achieve from a better rated guarantor taking the credit risk from them. So that's the product. Who is the market? The market is the global property and casualty insurance market, the Lloyd's of London insurers, various specialty insurance entities, all of whom rated single A or better. So you're distributing what is often sub-investment grade credit risk into significantly improved credit enhancers or credit counterparties being the insurers. And in that case, with that, you're syndicating risk across a number of different insurance providers. One of the things that our product and our market can provide is scale. There is potentially around 40 insurers, give or take, who can offer this product to the development institutions. And through syndication, through building scale across these insurers, you can reach transactions of many hundreds of millions, if not billions in size. So when we talk about the obstacles for risk transfer and, you know, the potential ways to improve it, the credit insurance market, the insurance guarantors that exist there are very much participants that would have a role in supporting development banks in optimizing their balance sheets in efficient ways. How can they do that? They can do that through single transactions. I think it was Eric and Federico referred to the CEDA transaction that they concluded a couple of years ago. You know, the private insurance market could potentially participate in similar structures with the development banks to facilitate increased lending into the sovereign obligations that a number of the development banks face in their member countries. They can work on single loans in the non-sovereign obligation side. All of these things can distribute the credit risk efficiently for the banks. But how can they do it in greater scale? Well, that's where the portfolio transactions come in. Clearly, the African Development Bank Room to Run transaction was a phenomenal deal and a market-leading transaction, which, you know, I think the insurance market would love to be participating in the next time round. How can they provide some form of credit enhancement in the tranches to allow maybe the unfunded product to economically improve the trade for the development bank while still maintaining the capital efficiency that the transaction could bring? You know, you have an insurance market now who regularly support, maybe in a more, I would suggest, limited liquidity. It's not the 40 insurers, maybe it's 10 to 12 insurers who regularly support commercial lenders and synthetic securitizations. They can apply that knowledge and that combination of partnership that they already have with the development banks to work on similar structures with them. I think, you know, we have a good opportunity here to combine what is a market who is already working efficiently with development banks. Insurers, for example, work closely with the IFC. There's their managed co-lending platforms and their various instructors. Hasatu referred to the ATI facility that they did back in, I think, 2019. These are insurance vehicles that are taking credit risk regularly from development banks. And what we want to do is make sure that that can be done preferably more programmatically. I think the important thing there is to understand, well, maybe the data that's available from GEMS is more limited, but actually insurers have a lot of historical data working with development banks individually already. So I think they come with knowledge and capabilities to support on an unfunded basis that maybe other commercial lenders can't bring. They struggle to understand the importance of the PCT. They struggle to take pricing benefit from that PCT and offer a pricing that can work from a development bank perspective, whereas the insurance market have a long history working with development institutions. They understand the PCT, they've seen it work, and I think hence they can be a more dynamic and certainly more scalable guarantor in these situations, and can work with the investors to create transactions that I think will achieve the risk-weighted asset relief that the development banks are looking for, and hopefully that the additional lending and mobilization that the product should bring to the member countries of these institutions. So I was given 7 minutes. I think I'm just under time for once. So I'll maybe pass back to Andreas and can take more questions, et cetera, during the panel.
Thank you very much, Simon. We're short of time, so I'm gonna move it right over to our next speaker. That's Chris Canavan. Over to you, Chris.
Andreas. Thank you. Thanks, everyone. Let me try to be quick. The goal I set for myself was to think about how risky assets could be transferred from MDB balance sheets to other balance sheets. I think I'm on to talk about the possible transfer to private balance sheets, other commercial banks, the insurance market, institutional investors, and the like, and to think about what the obstacles to that might be. At least for me, it helps to begin with a couple of premises, which I think are probably self-evident and perhaps obvious to all of you, but helps clear my mind anyway. One is that, as has already been discussed, an MDB is essentially a bank in that it uses equity. It borrows on the basis of that equity and then it on-lends, but it's a bank with a twist. The way in which MDBs are different from large commercial banks, for example, is that number one, their equity essentially comes for free. They don't have to promise dividends or capital gains to their investors. And of course, they have preferred creditor status. And I think it's worth laying out that twist, describing that twist to sort of understand the implications of that clearly. The second premise that I have when I think about a risk transfer, if, for example, I were called upon, as in a previous life, I was occasionally called upon to engineer transactions that would transfer risk from one balance sheet to the other, is that if risk transfer is to be done at scale, and I think that that's what we're here to think about, then it needs to be financially sustainable for the multilateral development bank, but it also needs to be attractive for the private balance sheet. So those are the two premises I begin with. MDBs are banks with a twist, and for risk transfer to be truly scalable, it needs to be financially sustainable for the MDBs, and it needs to be attractive financially to the private balance sheets that are receiving it. So now let's consider the case in which an asset or a portfolio of assets is transferred from an MDB's balance sheet to another balance sheet, a private balance sheet, but without the benefit of preferred creditor status. Then I think it's pretty clear that that private balance sheet will require a substantially higher risk premium to take on that risk, because that higher risk premium will be needed to make up for the much higher weighted average cost of capital the private balance sheet has. It doesn't get equity for free, and it may well not be issuing AAA debt, but it's also not a preferred creditor. And so it'll require a much higher risk premium than the MDB applied. And so that transfer will, in one way or another, crystallize a loss on the balance sheet of the multilateral development bank. The MDB will have to effectively transfer that risk at a discount, potentially a steep discount, in order to encourage the private balance sheet to take it on. And this kind of transfer may be worth doing from time to time based on idiosyncratic circumstances. But if what we're talking about here is finding ways of transferring risk scalably in a way that really, you know, moves the dial at a global level, then my guess is that there are limits to transferring risk if preferred creditor status is not going with the asset. This, I'm not making a point that hasn't already been made. I'm just sort of taking you through the way I approach this. I suppose one exception to that is if MDBs were to take the very strongest segments of their portfolios and securitize just those, in the hope that that the discount required to make the transfer happen is not all that great. In fact, perhaps no discount would be required. And that's not exactly a bad outcome, right? That would mean that MDBs would be taking their very best credits, transferring those, and the credits that stayed behind were the ones that were far less creditworthy. But from a policy point of view, that might be a good outcome. That means that MDBs are focusing their attention where their attention is most needed and most valuable. And my guess, others will agree or disagree, but my guess is that even if the credit quality of these of MDB portfolios deteriorated as a result of transferring the very best of their credits to private balance sheets, that probably doesn't jeopardize their spreads or their ratings too terribly much. Others may have a different view. I do think that there may be political challenges to doing that. I'm not sure that MDBs can skew their portfolios away from traditional borrowers. But if those challenges can be overcome, then maybe that's one way of doing it. But the moral of the story is that, at least from where I sit, it's hard to imagine risk transfer at a truly scaled up volume that doesn't involve the transfer of preferred creditor status, because otherwise that means either systematic losses for the MDBs or private balance sheets that are simply not interested in taking on these assets. So for me, that means the attention ought to be focused on how to transfer preferred creditor treatment or status as effectively as possible. As the authors of the paper and some of their previous work has shown, there's very strong evidence that assets that benefit from preferred creditor status or that are treated with a preferred creditor in mind have much lower probabilities of default, much lower losses given default. So their expected losses are much smaller. And if you were to transfer that to a private balance sheet, even one where the cost of capital is much higher, the improvement in the creditworthiness, the enhancement in the creditworthiness of these assets because of the preferred creditor status is probably more than enough to compensate for the higher cost of capital on the private balance sheet. And so that means that in order to scale this up, we have to really develop a much better understanding and help the rating agencies and investors and others develop a much better understanding of what preferred creditor status really means. And also, as Andy and others have pointed out, how a status that is de facto, but not de jure, and therefore difficult to write contracts on, can nevertheless be transferred effectively. And here, I think, Andy, I'm not sure I'm quite as optimistic as you are, because while it's true that there have been risk transfer transactions that have moved assets from an MDB balance sheet to a private balance sheet and carried with that transfer the preferred creditor status, as you and others, Hasatu, I think you pointed this out as well. Very often it's done in a way that in a sense disguises or cloaks the identity of the ultimate balance sheet by keeping the MDB as the lender of record, not disclosing that any of this risk has been transferred and the like. And I think that underscores a very important point, which again, I'm only repeating, it's already been said. And that is that potentially when you transfer an asset from a preferred creditor's balance sheet to a non-preferred creditor's balance sheet, that could alter the behavior of both the borrower knowing that it now owes money not to a preferred creditor, but to just another mutual fund, may decide to think differently about willingness to pay, but it may also alter the behavior of the MDB. And here I'd like to just briefly talk about an example, a precedent, which is now quite a few years ago, in the case of Argentina, a transaction that I was involved in which the World Bank provided a partial guarantee on debt service payments on bonds issued by Argentina in 1999, I believe. This wasn't an example of risk transfer so much, but I think that the issues apply. Of course, we know that Argentina subsequently defaulted on its bonds a year and a half or so later. And the question was whether they would default on these bonds that benefited from a partial guarantee from the World Bank and therefore benefited from the World Bank's status as a preferred creditor. The way the transaction worked was that if Argentina missed a debt service payment, then the World Bank would step in, make that debt service payment, and that debt service payment would effectively be deemed a new loan to Argentina, but a loan that would have to be paid back, if memory serves me, in 180 days. And of course, if Argentina failed to pay back that loan in 180 days, then it would have defaulted on a preferred creditor, on the World Bank, and all of the sanctions that would come as a result of that would fall hard on Argentina. Argentina presumably would be loath to see that happen, would repay the bank, and the guarantee would spring back into place. So in that way, these bonds would be insulated from the default that had just occurred on all of the other sort of plain vanilla bonds. What happened in the event was that Argentina missed its debt service payment and the clock started ticking. The World Bank made the payment and the clock started ticking to see whether Argentina would repay the World Bank in the allotted time. And at the 11th hour, the World Bank stepped in and decided that instead of seeing its preferred creditor status tested in this way, it would instead extend the maturity of that loan from 180 days to 5 years and effectively nullify the fundamental quality of that insurance policy. So in that way, you know, that the very obvious fact that although the World Bank was putting up its preferred creditor status, the lenders, the ultimate lenders were private bondholders, altered the way, perhaps the way Argentina, right, the borrower thought about this, but also altered the way in which the MDB thought about it. And I raise that issue because I think that the focus ought to be on how to construct risk transfer transactions that carry the preferred creditor status from the MDB balance sheet to the private balance sheet. I think otherwise this isn't terribly scalable, but it also raises really deep issues and challenges. Basically, you know, what economists like to call time and consistency challenges, which can be dealt with, but I think still require quite a bit more financial engineering and political commitment to make preferred creditor status a credible form of insurance that can be essentially relied on by private balance sheets when they take on the risks that have been originated by multilateral development banks. So I think I'll leave it at there because I'm sure I'm at or beyond 7 minutes. So back to you, Andres.
Thank you, Chris. You're a little bit beyond, but not too much. Before I turn it over to Nancy, I just want to remind participants that you can upload questions. We've got 4 questions. We don't have a lot of time, but maybe there can be other questions that can be grouped and passed on to speakers. But before we do that, we certainly want to hear from Nancy. Nancy, floor is yours.
Thanks so much, Andres. I'm also delighted to join this conversation and to discuss really what I think is an excellent and very useful paper. I think I'm going to try to do something a little different, which is to put this discussion in the broader context of the kinds of adaptations necessary in MDB models to address, you know, the short-term challenges, long-term challenges, and all the aspirations of shareholders. Mm-hmm. We know that those aspirations involve doing a lot of difficult things and often things that are in tension with each other in practice, mobilizing a lot more finance for SDGs, doing a lot more in poor countries and fragile states, stretching capital while preserving institutional ratings, boosting finance for global public goods while meeting country-specific needs, and allocating scarce concessional finance where it can do the most good. And of course, there's a lot of debate about where it can do the most good. So I'd like to put the question of risk transfers as part of these larger strategic issues and questions. And here I'm going to focus only on risk transfers for private transactions because of the specific problems associated with transferring sovereign risk, as Simon was just mentioning. So I'll try to define more broadly objectives for risk transfers. Second, add to the discussion of constraints or complications that is so well covered in the paper. And third, suggest some broad principles that might guide decisions about when to do risk transfers and how large they should figure in portfolios. So on objectives, I think the objective number one is that risk transfers allow MDBs to make use of what perhaps is their primary comparative advantage, and that is origination of strong and credible SDG-related investments. They have a unique set of advantages, expertise and knowledge, on-the-ground presence, a flexible toolkit, large networks, and a partnership building capacity that includes both the public and the private sector. No other institutions bring that all together under one roof. Of course, we have seen that MDBs sometimes have trouble deploying those tools coherently, but nevertheless, they are unique in that way. So one purpose of risk transfers is to help MDBs focus more of their activities on early stage project development and early stage finance. But MDB should also be helping to make markets, including building SDG asset classes and investor interest in them. And that's the second purpose, as I see it, of risk transfers, including the notion of connecting MDB assets with securitization and insurance markets, as Simon was just describing. And third, risk transfers can help MDBs shift their portfolios faster to activities which shareholders prioritize. So in the current context, that means a lot more lending for climate-related finance, mitigation and adaptation. It means more lending to poor countries, and it means more pandemic response and boosting pandemic resilience. So if these are the broad objectives, what are the constraints? They're well covered in the paper, but let me add a few more. I would stress that it's important to avoid too high a cost for risk transfers. And now I'm speaking from the public perspective rather than the private perspective. That cost includes both concessional finance that is offered as part of a transaction, as well as the direct cost of the transfer. In fact, I have to say, and this may be a little bit controversial, the rationale for using any concessional finance in these transactions is actually not obvious to me. We're talking about underlying assets that are performing. They are likely beyond the early stage where risks are often concentrated. In the room to run securitization, the AFDB retained first loss exposure, providing protection to investors. The securitization was synthetic, as we heard, so the AFDB remains the lender of record, and that imparts at least a halo effect, if not the PCS that has been described and is clearly of value, as Simon was saying, to investors. And risk transfer in general can be done in a way that customizes risk allocation and risk-adjusted returns to the preference of the private sector participants. So if it's not possible to find private actors that are interested on those terms, then the rationale to me for the transfer itself is not clear. The second challenge is that risk transfers could complicate or set up conflicts in MDB origination choices and decisions. MDBs are being pushed to take on more risk in difficult environments and more subordinated positions that are more catalytic in raising private capital. That doesn't mesh very easily with a drive to scale up risk transfers. The riskier the credit, the harder it will be to maximize the efficiency ratio criterion described in the paper, that is the ratio between the reduction in capital charges and the share of the interest rate margin that is spent on the risk transfer. And finally, there's the fundamental question of the effects of risk transfers on MDB net income, which has already been touched upon. MDBs, after all, like commercial banks, are funded largely by spreads. If MDBs move to an originate to distribute model for most of their activities, they will likely have to change their own financial models, and shareholders will have to consider the implications of a potential reduction in net income in some cases for the frequency of capital increases, since net income has been an important contributor to capital. So what does this suggest for principles to guide risk transfer decisions? Let me suggest five. MDBs should minimize the cost of risk transfers, as the paper suggests, and as Hasetu and Andy have mentioned, through more transparency on track records to reduce risk perception and therefore the cost of risk transfers as assessed by credit rating agencies and investors. Number two, MDBs should avoid as much as possible deployment of concessional finance components as part of risk transfers. Concessional finance should instead be concentrated in helping MDBs bear early stage project costs and risks in order to expand the pipeline of bankable projects whose risk can later be transferred. Three, MDBs should use capital freed up by transfers to shift their portfolios to priority areas and not create a bias that favors projects simply because their risk is easily transferred. Four, MDB should maintain their ability to protect environmental and social standards and development objectives in administering the projects once risks have been transferred. And five, and this is something I think Tim mentioned, risk transfer should not be deployed as a substitute for capital increases and may actually, in some cases, have to be combined with additions to capital. So, those may or may not be agreeable to everyone. I'm sure we could come up with other principles, but the general point I'm trying to make is that if done well, risk transfers can advance the overall strategic objectives of MDB adaptation, but if done badly, they can significantly undermine those overall objectives. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Nancy. I agree with pretty much everything you said, especially that last point. This is a complement to more capital. It is not a substitute for more capital. We have maybe 15 minutes left, so I'm going to turn to some of the questions. I see Andy has his hand up. Andy, you want to come in and say something before we move to the questions? You're muted, so I don't know.
We can take some questions first, if you prefer, whatever.
Well, I wanted to get the ball rolling by asking a very sort of general question, which is quite related to the first question in the chat. So here it goes. I want to go back, you know, I'm just a macroeconomist. I'm not a finance guy, so I want to make sure that I understand what's going on here. I think it was Federico at the very outset who said, what we need here, if you know, if the Swedish government, say, happens to have, you know, an extra billion or two sitting around, alternative A, Swedish government guarantees the IDB or the African Development Bank. Alternative B, the Swedish government guarantees some private lender, which in turn lends to the developing country. Correct me if I'm wrong. What I've heard here is two arguments for having the guarantee go to the MDB. One is simply that you get two rounds of leverage and not one run of leverage. You know, the IDB is leveraged, so the IDB can use its capital more effectively. And then, of course, it lends to someone who can lend more to the country in question. But the second one, which is more subtle, and this is new to me, is that, and I think this is where the problems come, that the IDB or the African Development Bank have this particular feature. They get paid first. And the difficulty, of course, is that if I transfer the risk to a private agent without necessarily passing on that capacity, then the private agent is going to charge me a great deal of money for that transaction. And I think this is exactly what Stephen Gooch was saying in one of the questions. Stephen Gooch introduced himself as saying that he works for the US Treasury. And he says, the biggest problem we have seen with risk transfer, particularly in the case of the African Development Bank, is the cost involved with quasi-securitization. In our opinion, it has come as a high cost relative to the income. And we have been concerned about the reinvestment risk associated with it. So I suppose Stephen Gooch knows more about this than I do, but is this the core of the matter? And if so, how do we make sure that the MDBs in fact can pass on this this particular feature they have that they get paid first? Federico and then Andy maybe on this. And I think William also wants to come in on this. Briefly, everybody, yeah. Because we only have a few minutes left.
So very briefly, and focusing on the sovereign guaranteed part, and also piggybacking on the excellent point made by Chris. So the Argentina World Bank problem was precisely that the World Bank guaranteed an external investor in Argentina. And I said at the outset, that we should avoid because it doesn't work. And by the way, there are a number of asset managers out there in the market who are saying that MDBs should guarantee asset managers. Right. It doesn't work. And Chris has just eloquently explained to us why it doesn't work. What does work is if an MDB gets a counter guarantee, because that means that the MDB remains the lender of record, maintains the PCT, and the counter guarantee benefits automatically from PCT. So the beauty of getting a counter guarantee like we do with the SIDA, with the Swedish International Development Cooperation Agency, is that we don't need to write anywhere our preferred creditor treatment because we remain the lender of record and Sweden benefits from it and they recognize it by charging us a minimal spread through a deal that went through the Swedish parliament. So you can imagine the amount of scrutiny this risk has taken. Again, just in a nutshell, MDBs are not designed to give guarantees, they're designed to receive guarantees, unless you're MIGA, and that's a different story. But most of us should receive guarantees. And then you will not have the Argentina World Bank problem.
On the same point, I see three hands up, so I will take them in the order in which they appeared on my screen. Andy, Hasatu, and William, but briefly, please.
Yeah, thanks. Well, thanks, first of all, to all the discussants, because they were really excellent interventions, all of them, and I really enjoyed listening to them. So first of all, thank you. But I did want to address this issue. I mean, you know, I'm an economist and Andres will understand this, you know. So when I hear very interesting points raised, like the one that Chris has raised, I want to write down a model. So that's what we did. A guy called Tito Cordella and I wrote down a model trying to understand why preferred creditor status is so persistent, even though it's not actually in legal contracts. And that's a paper that's published in the Journal of International Economics. So I don't have time to go into the argument, but the critical feature of MDBs is I think commitment, right? That is the critical feature. So and makes them very distinct from private lenders, commercial lenders. So one, MDBs can actually say, we're gonna restrict lending. We're not gonna lend more money at a certain point. And secondly, can restrict, can you hear me?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And secondly, can give commitment onto the sanctions, and all MDBs have sanctions. And by the way, it's not just the MDB sanctions. The IMF also, you know, they have a certain lending into arrears policy, which actually they've just been revising. And I think the new version is either, it's either going to the board or it's gone to the board, which states, you know, that if a country's in arrears with an MDB, then the IMF will not disperse to that. To that country. So preferred credit status is supported by the Paris Club, by the IMF lending into arrears policy, and actually it's restated by the G20 and the DSSI and the common framework. So you know, preferred credit status is supported by these things, and there's also a way of modeling it as a consistent dynamic equilibrium in economist terms. But it does depend on certain commitments. And your point about risk transfer, this problem already exists, right? Why would MDBs apply certain sanctions to a country? I mean, that problem is already there. So this isn't specific to risk transfer. And the point that Federico just made is a very important one, that the lender of record is the MDB. It's not, you don't transfer, the MDB cannot transfer preferred credit status. Preferred credit status is something which is given to the MDB from the sovereign, from the borrowing countries. There is no way that an MDB can transfer PCT. PCT is something which is extended by the sovereign. So we just have to make sure that the structure, the international financial architecture, which maintains PCT, is also applied if risk transfer takes place and the MDB remains lender record. Thank you.
Thank you. As a tool.
If I may talk about the pricing.
Right.
Okay, so basically for each of the transactions that go to the board, we have like a cost benefit analysis that we have to do, a minimum cost of 1.3. So yes, there is an impact on the net income, but that impact you have that in the earlier years. However, over time, that cost is expected to be compensated by the additional lending that you would be able to do because you've increased your headroom. So, and it's quite interesting because obviously Moody's, which rates the African development banks, did indicate in their report, in one of their reports, that while guarantees and insurance come at a financial cost to MDBs at the time of the transaction, the impact on profitability is likely limited and offset by the credit benefits of reduced risk. So as a result, they are unlikely to significantly weigh on the MDB long-term profitability. So that says it all. So indeed, I mean, the first transactions that we've done were done at a certain level using the cost-benefit analysis, but there's been a demonstration effect. The transactions that we've been able to execute afterwards, the pricing has been reduced. And also one thing to highlight is on these transactions that we have, despite the COVID-19 crisis, that those transactions have performed. So these are things also that comfort us. And last thing, MDB is not about profit maximization. We have to balance between financial returns and social returns. Very important, that's the MDB model. What we lend, for example, to the sovereign is not based on the risk rating of the sovereign that we price them, it's the same price for everybody. So, we are balancing that. We are creating social, we are doubling social return at a certain level of financial return. So let me stop here.
Thank you. William wanted to come in on this very briefly, please.
Yeah, just very briefly. PCT is a technology, it's a commitment technology that's exemplified by or implemented by MDBs. It's massively efficient. Just if you just want to understand PCT, it mainly operates through LGDs. If you take the typical MDB LGDs on sovereign loans, they're 5%. If you looked at a commercial lender, maybe they'd be 50%. That means that the capital required to support a portfolio is 10 times larger if it's in the hands of a you know, commercial lender, it's a massive difference in the quantitative credit performance of these loans, whether it's held through an MDB or a commercial bank. So communicating the scale of it is really important, which is why we talk in our paper about the data. And it really should be reflected in rating agency methodologies. It's a dramatically different credit performance. And this all comes, as Andy was saying, because of a commitment mechanism. MDBs don't go away. If you took a loan from, you know, you get some loan from some bank that looked permanent, like Lehman Brothers, good luck to you. You get a lending relationship with the African Development Bank, they're not going to be, they will still be there in 30 years' time. You're actually represented on their board if you're a member government. There's all sorts of reasons how there are different mechanisms for this thing that we call PCT, but it's of dramatic quantitative significance.
Thanks very much. We're going to take an additional 5 minutes. It's 7 p.m. exactly in London. So I want to ask a couple more questions that are here in the chat. And again, you know, some of the topics and themes recur, but I think that's a good thing because that means we're focusing on the core. Let me read a question from Baina Duff, who is an EMPA at the LSE. And the question is, talking about risk transfer and pricing, what is the usual pricing for low-income countries and how much of a difference does it make if the country is middle-income or low-income? And in addition, is there a market for risk transfer in local currency, not just in dollars or some major currency? Anybody want to take a crack at that? Simon, is that...
Andreas, yeah, happy to try and take that one on.
Thank you.
I mean, I think from a sovereign perspective, there's no difference from a pricing for the African Development Bank or IDB, depending on whether or not they're a middle income or a low income country. Right. And therefore, it comes down to the risk transfer participants as to whether or not they can achieve a sufficient return on their capital to participate into the lower income transactions or lower income economies at the same pricing as they would receive for a middle income economy. So part of that is certainly from an insurance perspective is understanding the PCT and getting confident and comfortable that they sit behind an entity that can bring a much better, as William and Andy refer to, LGD in the event of a default. And I think that is where, you know, the insurance market has the capability to understand that maybe more efficiently than the asset managers or the sort of traditional commercial lenders. And then, you know, from a second perspective, yes, local currency is clearly important. And yes, there is potential to distribute that risk into, again, the insurance market. They're there to bring in from their side, you know, a multiplier and a capacity building product for development banks. And they recognize that actually, although clearly PCT is less important for local currency, there's a credit enhancement to lending in local currency from a repayment obligation perspective. So yes, you know, there may well be access to local currency from a indemnification perspective, but as long as they recognize that the underlying deal and their insurance product marry up from a currency perspective, it's an attractive way of supporting what would probably be a very much beneficial, a much more beneficial product for some countries who, you know, who have the capacity to repay somewhat more easily in local currency. So yes, I guess yes to both. Local currency is possible, and you know, it's about further explaining that story of PCT. And I think, you know, you have a market who understands that, and therefore, you know, they have some catalytic capability in the low income countries.
Wonderful. I think we have one last question from a student, which I'm going to read out. It's a very specific question. Rodney, LSE student from London, says that William mentioned that he'd carried out his risk analysis using the S&P ratings methodology. And Rodney would like to know whether similar work has been done using the Fitch methodology or the Moody's methodology. and whether that those results, if they exist, could be shared with the audience. I don't know if William or somebody wants to address that briefly. William, can you quick crack on that?
Very briefly. There's two sides to it. The three rating agencies use transparent, highly quantitative, similar but different approaches for looking at securitization ratings. So they're rather similar. On the approaches that they use, the rating, the multilateral banks, they vary. In the S&P is much more quantitative, much more transparent. And so MDBs typically look more at S&P, or people look more at S&P than they do at the other rating methodologies. And so it was natural for us to use the S&P approach because we could do a transparent analysis. Mm-hmm. But we could have done the same. We could have used the different rating agencies for the rating of the risk transfers. I don't think we'd have got very different results.
Wonderful. We are 6 minutes past our allotted time. So beyond I say thank you and goodbye, I just want to ask any of the organizers, whether Andy or Hassatu on behalf of the African Development Bank, or maybe Eric, to share a few parting words of wisdom. Anybody who'd like to seize that important role?
Let me say something, Andres, and probably a big thanks to the authors and to the discussants, but especially to our host. So this has been a brilliant discussion. So I am also a simple macroeconomist, but I learned a lot in this session. So thank you very much for that. As Nancy said, this is only one alternative of many, and I think everything is very useful to support our emerging market economy. So we need that. So thank you very much again, Andres, and all of you.
Thank you, Eric. Thank you, everyone. I am going to agree that we've had a great discussion. I myself have learned a great deal, and I'm sure the audience did too. The subject matter could not be more important. As we always tell our students, we need good intentions, but we need the cash to finance those good intentions. And there's a lot of private capital out there. And the question is how we can leverage public money and use public balance sheets more effectively. It may sound like a technical financial question, but it's really a question that is at the core of sound development and sound international finance. So to the IDB, the African Development Bank, and everybody else who joined, thank you very, very much. To the students and others from the UK and from the world at large who joined the call, also thank you. And I hope to see you soon at another School of Public Policy, LSE public event. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks, Andres. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Hasta luego.
Hasta luego.
Ciao.